morning to you all, and welcome to the Court of Appeals. We've reconstituted the panel. Now we have myself, Judge Ross, and replacing Judge Connolly, we have Chief Judge Frisch on the panel, and Judge Wheelock continues to be on the panel. Counsel, this is our third case on our calendar, and it's the case of Whitman versus Highland Management Group. Each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument, with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel, if you'd like to use that time. The timing restrictions are indicated in the light and clock in the lectern, so please be mindful as you continue, as you proceed with your argument, of those restrictions. And you'll note that there's a lever or button in front of the lectern that allows you to raise or lower it to your height to match your own height for your convenience. Counsel, we also ask that you state your name as you commence each leg of your argument, because. Counsel for Appellant, whenever you are ready, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Christopher Kalla. I represent the appellant, defendant, the landlord in this rent escrow action appeal. The tenant, the plaintiff respondent, rented an apartment from the landlord. The lease began in October of 2023. The record reflects there was no issues with the condition of the apartment when he began his tenancy, certainly no issues as it related to bedbugs. In May of 2024, the tenant complained to the landlord about bedbugs. On June 6th, there was a heat treatment. I believe July 12th was the last found bedbug in the apartment. Referee Reed concluded at finding of fact number 24 that the landlord's response to the problem was timely, and it was effective. The court nonetheless awarded damages to the tenant, and we are appealing that on two issues. This case reflects primarily on 504B161. I don't believe there are any facts in dispute. As such, we believe the standard of review is de novo. I do note that the respondent cites to the Scroggins case and suggests that the remedy of a rent escrow is discretionary with the referee. Generally, I would not disagree with that. However, in this case, because the law is clear that there is no strict liability under 504B161, to award the tenant anything in the light of damages is not only abuse of discretion, it's an error as a matter of law.
The argument that there's no strict liability, that originates from your contention that 504B161 is a derivative of the common law? Is that right? I'm trying to understand the argument.
Sure. So Myers v. Parkin talks about Minnesota Court of Appeals, I believe that was 1985, says that 504B171 at the time, and then later on 504B161. Says, and this is the last paragraph in Meyer v. Park in 1984, the legislature did not intend to eliminate the element of scienter from the rule that a lessor has a duty to warn the lessee of any concealed defects the lessor knew or should have known. And then we have the Rush v. Westwood matter, and it says that the landlord's covenants to keep the lease premises in reasonable repair and fit for the intended use do not impose strict liability upon a landlord or expand the landlord's liability that was previously articulated in case law. Prior to Meyer v. Parkin and the statutory, it was caveat emptor. The landlord had no duty to warn, and the landlord is only held liable in cases of fraud or misrepresentation or concealment.
Now, the statute has undergone a number of amendments since those cases. And do any of those amendments, are any of those amendments relevant to your argument?
So there was the answer is no. The most recent amendment to 504B161 appears in subdivision 1A2. And that is including now to keep the premises and all common areas in reasonable repair during the term of the lease or license. That's always been part of it. And since January 2025, now included is including services and conditions listed in Section 504B3D1, sub 1, and extermination of insects, rodents, vermin, or other pests on the premises. I don't believe this was the statute that was enforced at the time this case originated. Regardless, that's really been the only, to my mind, change in the statute. The essence of not being a strict liability and imposing upon a reasonable duty of care to the landlord, that's remained unchanged. We take the position that the bed bugs in that apartment, the landlord doesn't have to demonstrate who caused the bed bugs. Certainly there's no evidence from the tenant's side that the landlord was the cause, or that the cause was something that the landlord could have done something about prior to the tenant bringing the bed bugs to the landlord's attention in May of 2024.
And is it your argument that the reasonability, the duty to keep the premises in reasonable repair imposes a causation requirement? Is that the argument?
Right.
I'm just having a difficult time understanding the legal chain of your argument. That's the basis of my question.
So starting with standard tort law, we have duty, breach, causation.
I get it. I mean, we're dealing with the statute, and I understand that you're arguing that the statute's a derivative of tort law. I'm trying to figure out where the causation requirement is baked in to the statutory language.
It's not. I mean, the statute.
It's not. So there's no causation requirement.
No, the statute embodies the tort liability construct. And with that, I mean, imagine there wasn't a causation issue. That turns into strict liability. I mean, if the landlord is responsible for remediating every problem in a tenant's apartment, regardless of the cause.
Or does it? I mean, does it really? I mean, can't the district court, in its exercise of discretion, determine what is what level of reasonableness is required of the landlord for repair of the premises?
Well, let's keep in mind, we're talking about two issues, repair or prevention. The landlord did repair. The landlord did not bill the tenant for the costs of the heat treatment. None of that was imposed upon the tenant. But to tell the landlord, not only do you have to fix the problem, but you have to basically pay for the consequential damages that the tenant incurred as a result of a problem that the landlord had no idea about prior to May of 2024.
I'm going to ask my question a different way, and that is, we're tasked with the responsibility of interpreting a statute here. What is the statutory language upon which you are relying that requires the outcome that you are seeking?
Subdivision 1A2 of 504B161. To keep the premises and all common areas in reasonable repair during the term of the lease or license.
And are you claiming that that language in the statute is ambiguous and that we need to resolve there's more than one reasonable interpretation of that language?
No, I'm saying that language is not ambiguous, but Meyer v. Parkin clearly says, again, reasonable care is the hallmark of tort law and liability and causation.
But correct me if I'm wrong, Meyer did not actually interpret this language. It did not say this is what this language means.
No, it says this is what this statute means. It says this statute is not meant to elevate the landlord's liability above what has traditionally been that of tort law, reasonable care. And I'm suggesting that the referee and the tenant is asking exactly for that. Because how could the landlord know about the bed bugs in the apartment before they happened?
I understand, I sympathize with the position that you're taking, counsel. Our traditional statutory interpretation looks at the language of the statute and goes from there. And I appreciate that we have previously spoken 4 decades ago about the overall purpose of the statute, but now we're dealing with specific statutory language, and I'm trying to, in our construct, in the construct that the Supreme Court has told us, how we're supposed to interpret statutory language, how do we get to the finish line? On behalf of your client?
I think we look to Rush versus Westwood from 2016.
Okay.
It's not strict liability. And to give the tenant the relief that the district court did can only be reached by imposing strict liability on the landlord. That's the only way we get there. And the case law is clear and consistent throughout that strict liability is not the standard. And there's nothing to demonstrate in the record that the landlord did anything that was unreasonable in responding to the problem. They remediated the problem.
Resch is an opposite to the case here, though, isn't it?
I'm sorry?
Resch is an opposite to the case here. It's distinguishable.
Resch?
Yes.
In what sense?
That's what you're citing to?
I'm citing Resch for the proposition that 504B161 should not be read for a strict liability standard. And that's, I believe, what the holding of Resch is. I mean, you're never going to find a case, well, you rarely find a case on all fours, but in Resch it was a bed bug issue. And the issue there was the method of treatment that the landlord wanted to do versus the method of treatment that the tenant wanted to do. And one of the premises for the findings in Resch was that it's a reasonable care, it's not strict liability. And from that premise, then, they ruled on the specific issues, the method of treatment in that case. I don't think Resch was about the measure of damages. It was about the method of treatment. Here, we're talking about the measure of damages. And again, we rely upon the same premise that Resch did, no strict liability, citing back to Meyer v. Parkin. The court did not make a specific finding as to the cause or the source of the bed bugs, but Mr. Lohman, the pest control contractor, said it was one of the worst he had ever seen. And the level of infestation in that apartment would not rise that greatly in just a matter of a week or so from the time that it was reported. It was a months-long issue. And I think that only leads to the common sense conclusion that that problem was going on for a lot longer. We don't know what the organic cause of the bed bugs in the apartment was. What we do know is that there's no evidence to suggest that the landlord was at fault for allowing the bed bugs to come in or allowing the bed bug problem to exacerbate. Hypothetically, let's imagine if there was an apartment right next door that
isn't
had been treated.
Isn't what you're pointing out, though, isn't it irrelevant unless you were asserting that, in fact, it was somehow malicious or willful on the part of the tenant to keep bed bugs in their unit?
So I think the malicious or willful exception in 504B161 refers to repair. Keep in mind, this statute, Chapter 504B, applies to all landlords and tenants, whether it's a single-family house or a 300-unit building like this one is, or commercial space, unless there's a specific carve-out. If you had a single-family house where the landlord's tenant crashed his car into the garage while he was driving drunk, the landlord would not have a duty to repair that. If it was a duplex, an apartment tenant A crashed into a tenant B's apartment door, yeah, then landlord has a duty to repair that for the other tenant, but not for the tenant who caused the damage. That's not what we're talking about here. That's not the exclusion we're relying upon to say this tenant is not entitled to damages.
And so if that's true, then it doesn't really matter where the bed bugs came from, right?
Well, if the tenant could have been found to be maliciously bringing in bed bug infested furniture, and I have had cases where that's the case.
You already said that you're not asserting that.
Right, right.
So then it's irrelevant where they came from in terms of applying, you know, 504B161 and the covenants to maintain the areas as fit for the intended use as well as keep the premises in reasonable repair.
Right, but I believe part of the argument from the tenant side is that's the only exception to 161 liability of the landlord, that if we can't show that the tenant was malicious or irresponsible or willful, then liability is presumed and mandated. I don't believe that's the case. I think the willful malicious only refers to repair, and we're not arguing that. That's one defense we have to repair. But what we're arguing here is that's not the totality of the defense that the landlord is able to raise here. We're raising the strict liability versus reasonable care. And we believe the landlord did exercise reasonable care. They responded promptly. They fixed the problem.
Would you agree that we're operating in within the context of the statutes at this point, however? So the application of the statutes that you've been citing, and we are not really operating in terms of applying common law in this situation?
Yes, I would agree with that. Yeah, the common law that predates Meyer v. Parkin and the statutory covenants of habitability was caveat emptor except for fraud and concealment. That changed with 504.18. I'm sorry, 504.18 was the original covenants of habitability. That's evolved into current 504B161. That changed the common law caveat emptor.
I don't know that it changed the common law, though. I think it said, okay, setting aside the common law, we aren't doing anything with the common law. It can exist as it is. We're adding this statutory construct to address this issue. And so it didn't displace common law. It simply said, we're putting a structure in place for how this is going to work.
Yes. Under the standard four elements of tort liability, duty, breach, causation, damages. And we're not arguing there has no damages or there's been a duty, but the duty here is not a strict liability issue. And unless there's a demonstrable evidence of the landlord being somewhat at fault, then Meyer v. Parkin, where there's no strict liability, and Rush v. Westwood, where there's no strict liability, says this statute does not allow the judge to give the tenant damages.
And kind of going back to the question my colleague was asking, where in the statute do you see that it requires that the landlord be found to be at fault for the existence of the condition?
Because the duty in 161 is reasonable care. And the landlord exercised reasonable care. I mean, the statute, you know, if the question is, does 161 say there's no strict liability? The answer is no. But the case law has interpreted and applied the liability standard in the covenants of habitability as being the standard tort and not raising the landlord's duty to a strict liability standard. Thank you.
Thank you. You will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Malia Ratliff, and I represent the respondent and tenant, Mr. Richard Whitman. This is a case about habitability, and the trial court properly awarded Mr. Whitman rent abatement for the 61 days that he was unable to live in his apartment and enjoy the full use due to a bedbug infestation. The trial court also properly awarded Mr. Whitman 50% of his hotel costs after he was forced to seek alternative housing accommodations. However, under the landlord's argument, Mr. Whitman would be left with zero recourse, despite the fact that he was constructively evicted from his apartment by hordes of bedbugs. I would ask that this court affirm the trial court's decision. Now I'd like to highlight a few brief facts. First, Mr. Whitman gave written notice of his bedbug infestation to his landlord on May 6, 2024. However, despite informing his landlord of the infestation, Mr. Whitman's apartment was not heat treated until June 6th, 1 month later.
Ms. Ratliff, I think we're familiar with the factual background of this matter. I want to draw your attention to your colleague's argument, which is that we've interpreted in the past these statutes to not impose a strict liability duty upon the landlord. How do you respond to that in light of your colleague's interpretation?
Yes, Your Honor. This case is about habitability. This is a case about the breach of the habitability covenant. And under Minnesota statute 504B.161 subdivision 1A1, Minnesota law establishes a covenant of habitability, which is read into every single residential lease, as it was here. And under that covenant, the landlord has a duty to make sure that the premises are habitable. And in this case, due to the severity of the bedbug infestation, argued, it was severe, and he was unable to live in his apartment, and that's what this case is about. It's not.
I think his argument. I'm sorry to interrupt. I think his argument is that duty is not absolute. That duty is only a reasonable duty, and then the argument is that the landlord demonstrated at trial, and it's undisputed that the landlord acted reasonably under the circumstances.
And I would disagree with the landlord's argument. It's not a reasonable duty. There's no reasonableness requirement in the statute. It's whether or not the premises are fit for habitability, which they weren't here.
And so how do we interpret subdivision 1, part 2, to keep the premises and all common areas in reasonable repair during the term of the lease or the license? What's the How do we interpret that language in the statute in light of our case law?
So subdivision 2, it does say to keep the premises in reasonable repair. We're not disagreeing that the premises were eventually repaired. It's the fact that the premises were uninhabitable for a period of time while the landlord was repairing it. And so our focus is really on subdivision 1 as opposed to subdivision 2, which does require reasonable repair. However, the breach of the habitability covenant was still there, regardless of whether or not the landlord was attempting to rectify the issue.
I'm curious how you would address, though, the language. To keep the premise in reasonable repair, what does that mean, reasonable repair, if it doesn't incorporate the reasonable standard for the landlord to respond to concerns?
I'm sorry, Yana, could you rephrase your question?
What does reasonable repair mean? The statute includes the reference to reasonable. How do you distinguish the statutory requirement from appellant's argument regarding what reasonableness means?
I would respond by saying that I don't believe that the issue is reasonableness. I believe that the issue is habitability. So we're not arguing, again, we understand that the apartment was eventually repaired. It was eventually heat treated to the point that all the bed bugs were gone. The reasonable repair that landlord is arguing is getting away from the crux of the argument. Again, it's about the time that he was not able to live in his apartment.
I mean, that is your argument.
Yes.
And I appreciate that, counsel. But the landlord's argument is different. The landlord's argument is, as a matter of law, the statute does not impose a strict liability requirement upon the landlord. And so I think what, and correct me if I'm wrong, Judge Ross, I think that what we're both getting at is, what do we do with the case law and the language of the statute? How do we reconcile your position with the legal landscape as we have it?
I believe that if we look further down into subdivision 2, if we look at where the malicious and willful irresponsible conduct comes in of the tenant, we don't have that present here. Again, Your Honor, I don't believe this is a case about statutory interpretation. And I understand that the landlord's argument is about the reasonableness in the statute, but we're not here about statutory interpretation. That's not what this case is about.
I thought that was what this case was about.
We're not arguing about what the statute says. The statute says...
But we're arguing about what the statute means.
We are not arguing about what the statute means. We're arguing about whether or not Mr. Whitman was entitled.
Does it mean what the appellant says it means?
Which is that the landlord doesn't have strict liability?
Yes.
We're arguing that the covenant of habitability was breached. We're not arguing whether or not the statute says one thing or another. We're not here about statutory interpretation. We're here about a breach.
Wait, but the appellant is arguing that when we apply the statute accurately, based on the language as it has been interpreted by case law, then the landlord is entitled to a reversal. I believe that's the argument. So why is that not the crux of what we have to decide?
Well, under the cases and the arguments cited by the landlord, those are all traditional tort liability cases. So a lot of the cases he cites are products liability, negligence. I believe there's some slip and fall cases which aren't applicable here. Those are getting to traditional liability, and they're not really applying the breach of...
Rush and Meyer?
Rush and Meyer is an opposite here. As the court previously pointed out, the Rush and Meyer didn't have any discussion of habitability. The only thing that's similar to our case in Rush is that there are bed bugs present. And in Meyer...
But those are cases that apply this statute, correct?
I don't believe they apply the statute in the same way that they do here. So, for instance, in Meyer, this case was used to stand for the proposition that rent escrow actions are merely the codification of common law tort liability, but this is a broad overstatement of the case's holding. In this case, the tenant brought damages for injuries that their child sustained due to formaldehyde exposure, and this dealt more with the scienter element of the duty to warn, and that's not at play here. We're not arguing about the duty to warn against unknown defects, and that's what the landlord is getting at. We're arguing that once a defect was known, Mr. Whitman was unable to still live in his apartment for 61 days, and it was uninhabitable. And that's why Myers and our case are different. And again, with Rush, this case doesn't discuss habitability. This case deals with the tenant's choice of treatment for bed bugs, not whether the tenant's apartment was habitable, and this was also never addressed by the court.
But there is a part of Rush that talks about whether there can be a per se violation of the statute. And so what do we do with that portion of the opinion? I mean, my recollection, and correct me if I'm wrong, counsel, I've read a lot of materials this week, but my recollection is that Rush provides that, or I think the district court rejected that there was a per se violation of the statute, and then we affirmed that finding by the district court.
Yes, I believe Your Honor is right. I think that the main difference there is what the damages were for. The damages were for property damage because the tenants wanted a different treatment. So I believe that they wanted a heat treatment instead of a chemical treatment because they had to remove their belongings from the apartment, and they would have had to pay for a heat treatment on their own if they wanted heat treatment. Instead, the landlord moved forward with the chemical treatment, and their property was damaged. And so the injuries were based off of property damage, not based off of habitability or any rent abatement, as is here. And so while I do agree with the court that there was, the court said there's no per se violation, there are completely different facts at play there.
Thank you.
Just so I'm clear, your argument then is anytime an apartment is uninhabitable for any reason, even reasons caused by the tenant, or exacerbated by the tenant, or prolonged by the tenant, landlord's responsible for any damages.
If the breach of the covenant of habitability is, if the covenant of habitability is breached, then is the landlord's responsibility to...
No, just to my question, I mean, I understand the legal framework you're putting in, but to directly answer my question, is that yes?
Yes, Your Honor. So to give a brief hypothetical, for instance, if I live in a one-bedroom, one-bathroom apartment, and my toilet is no longer working, and I ask for the landlord to fix it, the landlord is required to fix it, and they have to keep the premises in reasonable repair. If I can't use the toilet for, let's say, a couple weeks or a month, I'm not able to live in my apartment. And so despite the reasons for the toilet being clogged, it's still the landlord's duty to make sure that I have a habitable apartment because this is an exchange. The tenant is paying the landlord in exchange for somewhere to live. And if they're not able to live in their apartment and they're still getting rent, then one end of the bargain is not being upheld. Your Honors, I'd also like to highlight a few cases that support tenants' position. Although I recognize there's not much Minnesota precedent on issue, I believe that the court should follow decisions of some of its sister courts, which hold that a bedbug infestation is part of a landlord's obligations under the habitability covenants.
Sorry to interrupt you again, counsel. I just want to go back to your previous answer. I mean, there is an exception baked into Subdivision 1, Part 2 for the willful, malicious, or irresponsible conduct of the tenant. But what if the tenant is just negligent, right, and not necessarily irresponsible or malicious or willful? What if they're just, like, putting way too much toilet paper down the toilet and it's continuing to clog the toilet, making the apartment uninhabitable? Would that be a situation where the landlord is still on the hook, even though a district court or a fact finder might say, oh, it's not willful, it's not malicious, it's not even irresponsible. Maybe it's, you know, a little negligent of some kind.
Yes, under that scenario, the landlord would be responsible because it's not willful or malicious or irresponsible. It is negligent, but it's not due to the tenant intending to clog the toilet. It's, again, due to the tenant's negligence. And under the statute, then the landlord would still be responsible for repairing and keeping the apartment habitable.
So even in a situation where the uninhabitability would be caused by the tenant and the landlord had nothing to do with it, the landlord is still on the hook?
Well, actually,
how does that square with the purpose of the statute?
Well, Your Honor, causation is not in the statute. I understand the landlord's argument is that it is, but causation is nowhere in the statute except for in Subdivision 2 where it talks about willful, malicious, or irresponsible conduct. And it doesn't matter who caused the issue. The fact of the matter is that the landlord is required to keep the premises in reasonable repair and also keep it habitable.
So you are arguing for strict liability?
No, Your Honor. We're arguing that.
What's the difference between what you just argued and strict liability?
Because strict liability, under the landlord's theory, there's a causation element, and there's no causation here.
So that strict liability applies. It doesn't matter what caused it. Landlord's responsible under the statute.
Under the statute, then yes, Your Honor. However, again, I'd just like to emphasize that there is no causation element in the statute. That's the landlord's interpretation, however.
And there's no reasonable care standard?
Just reasonable repair, which is in the statute.
But no reasonable care?
Reasonable care on whose part?
The landlord.
On the landlord's? No, that's not in the statute, Your Honor.
No, I know it's not written into the statute. Based upon the case law cited by appellant, your argument is that that's not incorporated into our analysis. And what's the basis of that argument?
My argument is that those cases aren't applicable because those cases are brought under different causes of action. And so I understand the landlord's argument. However, those cases are not applicable here. I see that I'm out of time. May I briefly conclude?
Yes.
In closing, Mr. Whitman's apartment was uninhabitable due to the severity of the bedbug infestation that he suffered for 61 days. The landlord's opening brief attempts to classify Mr. Whitman's infestation as a mere inconvenience. However, this was more than a mere inconvenience. As evidenced by witnesses at trial.
I mean, can you say briefly conclude? You can wrap up in a sentence.
The infestation was so severe that bedbugs were scaling the walls of the apartment. The trial court properly awarded Mr. Whitman rent abatement and 50% of his hotel costs, and I'd ask that this court reaffirm the decision.
Thank you. Any rebuttal?
Thank you. I'd like to start by talking about Meyer v. Parkin at, and within head note two, referring to the newly enacted 50418. On its face, the statute purports to impose strict liability on a landlord without regard to his knowledge of the defect. But then at head note three and four, the court says, it seems clear that the legislature did not intend to alter a landlord's tort liability, but only to require a landlord a covenant to keep the leased residential premises in reasonable repair, fit for their intended use, and maintain in compliance with applicable health and safety laws.
I mean, with all due respect to my predecessor colleagues, it does seem inappropriate to be discussing the intention of the legislature when we're talking about an unambiguous statute. Wouldn't you agree that
except,
that's our law?
Except that's what the court did in 1984, and that's what we've...
40 years ago, right?
Well, Rush v. Westwood in 2016 has reiterated that. And I would suggest that as an error-correcting court, the trial court referee had a duty to apply this case with this facts under the Meyer v. Parkin and Rush v. Westwood precedent.
So, you know, the other troubling, you know, I appreciate and understand the argument, Mr. Calla. The troubling thing that I keep running into with this case is that the legislature has amended this statute many, many times, just looking at the recent history, and has not chosen to clarify anything other, any exception to the requirement of the covenant of habitability other than the actions of the tenant that are willful, malicious, or irresponsible. That is the exception, it seems to me, to strict liability.
That's the exception to repair. Now, the problem...
That's what we're talking about here,
no,
right?
We're not. No, there's no dispute that the landlord endeavored to repair the problem. They did. What we're talking about is the second issue, is the tenant entitled to his consequential damages because of the nature of the problem? That's the question. Okay, we're not running away from the landlord's duty to repair the problem. We're not saying it was willful or malicious as a matter of, you know, within this case, to excuse the landlord's decision to repair or not repair, because they did. And so I don't think that question is before this court. The question is, in light of the landlord doing that and the referee at finding of fact 24 saying it was timely, is the tenant still entitled to damages? And I take issue with counsel's suggestion that he has no options. He could have had renter's insurance. I mean, that's what people do. They have renter's insurance to take care of these problems. If you're a homeowner and you get bed bugs.
Well, that's shifting the burden to the tenant, which is antithetical to the covenant of habitability. Don't you agree?
If we're talking about the landlord's duty to repair under 161 and the tenant's damages, the landlord can't be a guarantor of all damages from a tenant. I mean, if the next door neighbor causes the problem, is the landlord on the hook to the tenant who got injured for the neighbor's causes? It can't be. But that's what this case would hold if we agree with the tenants, that the next door neighbor can cause the bed bugs in Mr. Whitman's apartment. We're going to repair it. But to tell the landlord, you're now responsible to the tenant for his damages over something the landlord had no ability to control, that a next door neighbor did this? I mean, I had a client one time
where... This is different than any other damage to an apartment, like floods or, you know, other kinds of water damage or mold or something like that. I mean, most of those situations are not things that are inflicted upon the units by the landlords. I mean, those are just acts of nature or other problems that just occur by nature of having properties where people live in them.
Right, and generally, the landlord is not running away from their duty to repair, but to compensate the tenant, that's another thing altogether. And that's what this case is about, the compensation of the tenant. And there's no basis to do that when the landlord had no idea about the problem to start with until Mr. Whitman alerted them, presumably months after the problem became a problem.
As I understand it, you're actually taking issue not only with the award of the rent abatement, but also with the fact that there was liability found here at all. And I guess I want to look at 504B161 subdivision 1A1 as opposed to 1A2. 1A2, which we've talked about a lot here, and my colleagues have asked you questions of you and opposing counsel about the reasonable repair language in that. But sub 1 says just that premises and all common areas are fit parties. And the intended use by the party here was to be able to live and sleep in that unit. And I guess I also don't see any language in here that says that it matters where they came from in the first place, the bugs, but simply that there's a covenant that the areas are fit for the use intended. And so I know one of your main points has been about strict liability. Doesn't that impose strict liability here in the statute, in the language that we're reading?
Well, I think Meyer v. Parkin says on first glance it might be, but Meyer v. Parkin says that's not the case. And the apartment was habitable when Mr. Whitman moved in. There were no issues with bedbugs at that time. There was no evidence that any other tenants surrounding him may have caused the bedbug problem to migrate into Mr. Whitman's apartment that the landlord should have or could have or was aware of. The landlord met its duty.
The duty, I think, that was discussed in Meyer, though, is distinguishable because it would hide somewhere in the materials that were in the the duty to maintain habitability that's being addressed in this case.
Sure. And so in Meyer, the landlord was not aware of the formaldehyde in the apartment. Here, the landlord was not aware of the bedbugs in the apartment of Mr. Whitman until Mr. Whitman told the landlord.
Correct. And so if we're looking simply from the time when they became aware of it on May 6th to the time when it was properly addressed, and we have those 61 days, and you look at the chronology of who was contacting who and the pest company coming in, et cetera, why, I guess I'm still struck with the fact that it wasn't habitable. So if it's not habitable and we're under subdivision 1A1.
Well, two things. First of all,
isn't there liability?
Well, referee concludes that the repair was timely and there was no cross appeal on the factual basis for that conclusion or finding. Second, the exception that you've just outlined would swallow the rule that there's no strict liability. If there's no strict liability up to the date of the event, May 6th, but there is strict liability afterwards, that's an impossible workaround.
Although your time's expired, I'm going to indulge with one other question. Does your interpretation of the statute, or why doesn't your interpretation of the statute, essentially ask us to decide all these issues under paragraph 2 and not for subdivision 1? I mean, it sounds like to keep the premises in reasonable repair would fit your argument, but why is there a need for the first provision that the premises in all common areas are fit for the use intended by the parties?
Well, I think the landlord did meet its burden under subdivision 1. Maybe I misunderstand your question. Hypothetically,
isn't the language under subdivision 1 superfluous if we apply subdivision 2 to all circumstances?
Subdivision 1 wouldn't be superfluous to Mr. Whitman's next-door neighbors. If the landlord's aware of the bedbug problem in Mr. Whitman's apartment and concludes, well, he brought the stuff in, he's at fault, we're not going to do anything with that, and then it spreads to his neighbor's apartment, I think my client has a problem with subdivision 1. But as it relates to the compensation of Mr. Whitman for his damages during the 61 days that the landlord was remediating the problem, I don't think the statute imposes any liability. I think Meyer v. Parkin and Rush v. Westwood, with the strict liability construct that the trial court should have followed, I think that's error. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel. Did you have a further question?
Nope, did not. Thank you very much.
Thank you to both counsel. The matter is submitted. We will issue our opinion within the statutory period. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, fine.
Okay, great. Thank you.
The court's in a